The Nature Stories podcast, where people and place intersect.
Support for this public radio podcast comes from Acura, featuring the all-new 240-horsepower turbocharged Acura RDX. More at acura.com/RDX.
You know, the vegetation that fell off in the river was called driftwood. It would just bank up everywhere like that, and they would, you could go down there and cut enough of it to cook supper and dinner and everything. And my dad and them always called it she-wood. That was because the woman of the house could go down there and just break that piece of limb over a log or something, and the little old pieces that go in the stove, she called it she-wood because she could do it, and it would burn a cook stove up cooking biscuits and beans and whatever you want, you know.
You're listening to the Nature Stories podcast. I'm Samantha Brown. This week, a piece about the Mississippi River and those who survived off of what the river offered them. This podcast is curated by Atlantic Public Media in collaboration with the Nature Conservancy and the Public Radio Exchange. Each week, we bring you pieces about the intersection between people and place. Up now, an excerpt from She-Wood and Cypress, The Mississippi River Rats, produced by Martha Hawley, with Radio Netherlands.
My name is Charles Bevel, and we're at Helena, Arkansas, United States of America. My dad and grandfather was commercial fishermen from way back. They come from Hickman, Kentucky, in 1934, and went to Louisiana. My mother and them got married there in 1934, and I was produced that year after, 1935.
Charles Bevel was born not far from where he lives now, on the western banks of the river in the heart of the Arkansas Delta. Growing up at the same time, but across the river in Vicksburg, Mississippi, was historian Gordon Cotton.
Growing up, that I was born in 36, I knew one family in the south end of the county who literally lived in a houseboat on the Mississippi River. And I don't know what their original name was. They had changed their name. I was always told that it was a very complicated name, that they had come down out of Missouri and on a flatboat and had docked south of town. And they had a bunch of children, like seven or eight, and lived on this houseboat, which had no screens on the windows. And, of course, there was no grass to cut. There are some advantages there. And they made their living by fishing and selling the fish out of the back of a pickup truck that parked in town.
We lived on that same place till I was about 8, 9 years old. Then we moved here to Helena. And my dad, he worked for the Corps of Engineers for a while and just fooled around till about 1945. He got called into the Army for the World War II. And he stayed in about a year or two. And when he come back in, in 1946, we moved down again south of here, about 20 miles out on the Mississippi River, and built a house there. We was living in a tent on the riverbank, just like the squatters, you know. And till we got enough lumber, he'd get lumber out of the river just from somebody's construction, and maybe he'd take a saw that's called a crosscut saw. They used to use them for cutting down big trees. They had two handles on you, go like that. But he'd make a frame, and he'd run that saw through here like this and cut a 4x4, split it open, and make a 2x4 out of it. He got enough lumber to build this house we lived in down there. We stayed down there till about 1955 or so, and he passed away about 10 years ago then, and everything like that. My mother's still living out about 10 miles out of town here.
She doesn't live on the river anymore. Doesn't she miss the river?
I doubt it.
I can't build a ship, my love, without the wood oak tree. The ship would burst asunder if I prove false to thee.
The limbs and stuff that come off these trees and in the river, everything that, the vegetation that fell off in the river was called driftwood. It would just bank up everywhere like that, and you could go down there and cut enough of it to cook supper and dinner and everything in a few minutes. They had a wood that was getting real soft, and my dad and them always called it she-wood, because he said That was because the woman of the house could go down there and just break that piece of limb over a log or something at the little old pieces that go in the stove. She called it she wood because she could do it. We didn't have a chainsaw and she had a chopping axe probably, you know, but it was just so easy to get. And it would burn a cook stove up, cooking biscuits and beans and whatever you wanted, you know.
I'm Annetta Beecham, and I was raised about an hour and 15 minutes from here, down on the Arkansas River. I was born in 1929, raised on a plantation, and then the children I went to school with were mostly, they were the children of river rats and bootleggers. I lived in what they call bootlegger country. In fact, in the hot summertime, when they were brewing their brew, the air was just heavy with it. I still like to smell a brewery. It takes me back. But we were 42 miles from anywhere and dirt roads. And at that time, if you lived in the country like that, there was no electricity, no gas, no water. So we lived really like 100 years ago.
Now that's before World War II,
right,
in the country. Did
mm-hmm.
people use the term river rats?
Well, yeah. And, well, you know, am I allowed to say a few things? You know, they called them white trash. that was a term. They were white trash. And it's not a very nice term, but that's what they were called. And but I liked a lot of them, you know. They were our playmates. But these children were just, oh, they were destitute. This was during the Depression, but very proud people.
My dad and them lived kind of like I am here, but it was a house on a rafted log that somebody had built down there. Of course, back then we didn't have TV and telephones nearly, and you know, and electric lights and everything. We had coal oil lanterns and heating stoves made out of half of a barrel, or just any way that people could get by. It wasn't really easy, and we always picked cotton and we chopped cotton and we eat everything that we could grow, you know, like that, like tomatoes and beans and corn and everything like that. And, you know, it was just from the time I was little till right now, I guess. I can still eat some if I had them like it.
Our schoolhouse, we only had 10 grades, and it was a three-room schoolhouse. First, second, and third grade in one room, fourth, fifth, and sixth in another, and seventh, eighth, ninth, and tenth in one small room, because almost everybody had dropped out of school by then just to work in the fields. And actually, we didn't have much school until November, because they were in the fields picking cotton, and then they had to get out early in the spring to chop the cotton. But they would come to school, and all they would have to eat was fried biscuits, just biscuits fried in bacon grease. And my mother and a few of the other women who lived a little bit better, you know, spent a lot of time canning and had plenty of food from the gardens and everything, decided we had wood stoves in the schoolrooms, and they decided they would just every day put a big pot on one of those wood stoves and dump all this vegetables and things that they had canned and have soup. These people said they wouldn't allow their children to eat it. They were very proud people. They didn't accept charity at all.
It's kind of like homeless people. Some you might feel sorry for. Others prefer it. And it's up to the individual. I remember a story here in Vicksburg in probably the 1950s. A lady who lived on one of the houseboats by herself. The word got out that she did not even have a mattress or a bed to sleep on. And the ladies at one of the churches here were upset about it, and they took up a collection to buy her a mattress and the sheets and all for her houseboat. And she thanked them very much, and she sold everything and got herself a new hairdo and things like that. She didn't care about sleeping on the floor. It was other people that were upset about her sleeping on the floor.
You lived in a houseboat on a raft of logs. Can you tell me more about what that looked like, what it was like?
All I know is what Mother told me. You know, it was like a house, and logs then was these big, this is a sycamore tree here, but them big trees you see back in my backyard, them cottonwood, they used to be long and lean, like a along here the top of the levee up yonder, and they would go down in the bottom of the river, and they would stay for several hundred years till the river course changed, and they'd come up and make a log, like a blue log. And they would float then, and the people would get them and just build a framework like this porch here on it, and then the house on top of it, you know. It would be sitting on it like it. Of course, I got a trailer here. I put this trailer here up here like this to keep the water out of it. But it's all it is sitting on them big posts you see back there on each side. And I jack it up there with a railroad jack. A railroad jack like you pick up the rails and stuff with. I did it all myself like that, you know, over a course of time, because I had a wife here then that, you know, that helped me in a little bit, you know. And you can't do that, and you can't do this, and all that stuff, but I did do it anyway.
Come all you young and tender ladies, be careful how you court young men.
My association with them was, well, at first it was an observer at a distance, but we got to be friends in school because I went to a small country school, and they went to the same school I went to. And I went to school with one of the girls. She was in my high school class. And in fact, I took her to the junior-senior prom and shocked a lot of people because they were people very class conscious. And to my knowledge, these people were hardworking, honest people. They had no education. They had no social graces, and they didn't care. But if they told you something, you could believe it. They didn't need to write it down. And, you know, I had a lot of respect for all of them for that reason.
I built this porch right here. I built that hump of dirt you see right there. All this was ground down yonder. I built that little old levee all the way around. It comes all the way around here. I was trying to stop the water from backing up in the backyard, but there was so many old bricks and cinders and stuff in it, the water just run right through it, you know, like that. Now I own the ground. I've had it for 35, 40 years already sitting here on this riverbank, but, you know, I can't live nowhere else cheaper.
I remember when Mrs. Lynn built a house on the land, a nice home. I remember my dad, who liked the Lynns, talking about the fact that Mrs. Lynn had come to the office where he worked. He was a surveyor, and she had come and talked to his partner, and who was also an architect, and she told him what she wanted, and this was 40 or 50 years ago. And he said, well, Mrs. Lynn, a house like that would cost $25,000, which was a tremendous sum. And he said that, Daddy said that she reached in her bosom and pulled out a wad of money and said, do you think I ain't got it? She was going to pay cash. And she built the house. But the funny thing was about the house, she still had no screens on the windows. But she did have her house on the land.
The people that lived along the river, were they all white, or were there white and black people living on the houseboats?
Mostly it was white people, but I have seen black people out there. And these people had an old houseboat, like, with a big engine in it, and they would come up the river, and these big cottonwoods like this, standing in my backyard, that then in big blues that I was talking about, they would cut the stump off of it and the top off of it and just leave it in one long piece, and they'd raft them together in logs, and they would take them back down to that sawmill, and they'd drag them out down there and make boards out of them.
Thelma Williams is a retired teacher living in Natchez. As a child there, Thelma did know one African-American river rat, but she didn't know what was going on in the white part of town.
Well, I feel...
Well, just as in activities on land, there was strict separation, segregation, I guess is the better word. Natchez had, and still has, but it had two separate areas on what is called the bluff. This is that position above the 200 feet or so above the river that the Spanish developed. So there were two separate areas on the bluff, one for blacks, one for whites. And I don't really remember what went on. I didn't look at what went on the white side of that divide. But we were almost constantly on the bluff. And under the bluff, down, it's called Under the Hill. Now, when I was small, there were still houses and people living down under the hill. My family did not permit us to go down unescorted because Under the Hill Natchez still had that reputation that carried over really from the 1700s, I expect.
Was there any one particular name for the people under the hill?
Well, they talked about pirates. They used that name quite frequently, even when I was small. Prostitutes. Ladies of the evening. I don't think my family ever used the word prostitute. Cutthroats. These kinds of names.
Was the word river rat ever in use in your family home?
Actually, the one man that I knew who was just openly referred to as a river rat, and he did not resent it, and, you know, his friends used it with him. I don't know how one ever stays sane in farms out there because the river floods. And this was a gentleman who farmed in they're called bottomlands. It's down on the river. And one almost has to be insane to do that because you plant these seeds and the river comes and takes them away. Or if it doesn't take the seeds away, it takes the seedlings. But he seemed to certainly never resented this name at all and was openly referred to as a river rat. It was not at all a name that he objected to. This was an African American. Fortunately, he had other sources of income.
The river rats and their friends are older now and fewer in number. But the torch is carried in surprising ways. Bottle historian Johnny Wayne Ross is an artist, a musician, and a singer. He lives just over the levee from the Mississippi River. Driftwood guarantees not his survival, but his art.
This was found along the Mississippi. What this is a creosote post that used to support your telephone wires and stuff. And it's aged, okay? And by being aged, I brought it back from behind the levee. When I saw the character in it. And so what I did, I brought it back, cleaned it out real good with my buffer and everything. And I just put 3 coats of interior-exterior varnish on it. And don't you think it's beautiful?
It is. It's a very shiny, dark wood. Yeah. What would people use that for decoration?
Well, it was pine. No, it's actually for your telephone posts that support your communication wires, you know? They're all along your road and everywhere, okay?
So this is Mississippi flood art.
I get it from different places, but most of my stuff comes from the river, right over the levee, which is, I guess, about a good block from my house.
A good block from my house.
And once you get over the levee, should you get over the levee, mm-hmm. How far is the actual river on the other side?
I guess about 100 yards. It depends on the level of the river. Sometimes it's just 5 feet.
Okay, this is the introduction of the album.
River grew up in the south, in a little Italian town, where people make fun of everything you do, and sometimes the way
Mississippi
found.
Flood art, a legacy worthy of the resourceful people known as river rats. Charles Bevel once said, "I don't care what you call me, just as long as you call me to dinner."
Yeah, we're the black man on the map.
All I did was just use the materials that I had and my brain every day to catch enough fish to get by. But where does the definition of river rat come from? Robert Titus, he used to be in the pawn shop. We'd talk about it, you know, and he was talking about calling me old river rat and all that stuff, you know. But he was a nice fella, you know, like that. But he passed away last year. He had a heart attack.
The parents of the children who lived on the river probably wanted a better life for their children, and consequently they lose something when that happens. But the descendants that I know here in town are, you know, just live normal everyday lives, and the fact that their grandparents were river rats is probably very foreign to them. They know little about it anymore. It's a part of our history that has just simply disappeared.
To hear more stories like these, go to the Public Radio Exchange, prx.org. This podcast is produced with support from the Nature Conservancy, online at nature.org/stories, committed to saving the last great places on Earth. Our theme music is by 35th Parallel. From Woods Hole, Massachusetts, I'm Samantha Brown. I'll be back next week with a new Nature Stories podcast.